Procedural comment. I'm going to send an email to everybody after class so that you can have a convenient way of just hitting reply. Where I would like to, I'd like to get your reactions now to how the class is moving with respect to this issue that we raised early on about discussion. Right? So we've now had a couple of weeks without any breaking down into smaller groups for more intense discussion and then reconvening, just having the discussion flow and intersperse with the presentation, which is what several people wanted, and I said, okay, let's try it out and see how it's going. I think what happens when we adopt that mode is it ends up taking up the whole time, and we've now done that for a series of times, and I kind of keep track as to who's talking, who's not. Quite a few people are participating, so that's good. But clearly, it's a different setting for discussion than if we break down and have more small group discussion than we convene. So I want your frank assessment as to how you're feeling about it. And then depending upon what people say, we'll either have a little discussion in class about it, maybe experiment with other modes, or we'll just try some other ways of doing it. But let me know. I'll send you all an email when I get back to my computer soliciting your feedback on that. Let me just briefly mention the other kinds of complexities besides the ones that I've already talked about. So the kind of complexity that I've been so far talking about are all complexities in the nature of the locations in a class structure themselves. In the nature of a location. You'll get a different picture of locations once you introduce contradictory locations or multiple exploitation or the other ways of solving that problem than if you stick with the binary polarized class map. So that's on the location side. The other complexities are more about how people are connected to locations. Although some of them have a little bit to, are other aspects of modifying the locations themselves. The first, which we'll be discussing in the class and gender section more systematically, is the notion of mediated class locations. I've already mentioned that. This is particularly relevant to gender. It's also crucial for children. The only sense in which a working class child is, quote, in the working class is by virtue of the family, not by virtue of their own location. Mediated locations are all the different ways that people are connected to class structures other than through their direct participation in economic activity. The family is the most important form of that, but kin structures more generally can be, and there may even in some cases be communal ways of connecting people to class structure through various kinds of community-based reciprocities that are not strictly kin-based or family-based. Career structures are another way. This creates what you could call the temporal character of class structures. In Japan, it used to be the case that most Japanese managers began their careers on the shop floor doing exactly what ordinary workers did. Now, this was not because they were actually ordinary workers and subsequently got promoted to be managers. They were already managers. They'd been hired into management. But the first stage of a managerial career was to spend a year or two on the shop floor doing the ordinary work of workers. If you were an outsider and didn't know this and came in and looked at the people on the assembly line and said, aha, these are all in the working class, you would be making a mistake because some of the people on that assembly line were really just pre-managers. You know, they were in the first stage of a managerial trajectory. And that really was their job. Their job was the first stage of a managerial trajectory. The future, that's an extreme case. The future character of their positions was already given, even though they were doing the same work as a worker.
But what does that pose, why does that pose a problem? I mean, those people are still managers. They still think in their manager's way. I mean, they know they're going to be promoted to
right.
that.
Right. So, but their actual work, the actual work they're doing, they're under the complete control of the supervisors. They don't have any autonomy, and they're exploited at that point. They're just like ordinary other workers. There's no different. They're not paid more just because they're future managers. But it would still be a mistake, and it's a mistake because class positions have a temporal character. And that's partially because the very notion of interests has a temporal character. Interests are a really interesting idea, and it's not so simple. If you ask, what are your interests? What are your interests? You really, what that really means is, what do you have to do now to improve your situation tomorrow, so to speak? Interests are always future-oriented. It's what's good for you, but of course that means what's good for you from now on. The interests of a pre-manager worker are different from another worker because the future of that person is different. It would be silly for that person to go on strike against management during the 1 year they're in the working class position because they would just be working against their longer-term trajectory. And that's what's embodied in the notion of interests, I think. This future-oriented. That's why Marxists can make the claim, because they have a much longer time horizon in mind when they ask what's in the interest of the working class. When Marxists say socialism is in the interest of the working class, that implies a very long time horizon in which you define what's in the interest of an actor, of people. Socialism is absolutely not in the interest of workers if you have a very short time horizon. There's no way that it's in the interest of people to struggle for socialism if your time horizon is a few months into the future. You know, interests have a time horizon, and that's a problem. We're going to, in the discussion of the concept of class compromise, and even more at the end of the semester when we talk about strategy, this issue of time horizons will loom very large. And it's one of the strengths of capitalism as a system that it shortens the time horizons. That's one of the ways that systems stabilize themselves, is by making it difficult for people to have long time horizons. Well, careers are one way that's reflected. Adding a temporal dimension also means that some aspects of a person's connection to the class structure are uncertain, because the future is not usually as determined as it is for these Japanese managers who are on the shop floor in the first year of their careers. Because of temporal ambiguities and the contingencies of the predictions about the future, there is also what might be called temporally indeterminate class locations. People have class locations connected to future states. They have class interests connected to future states of the world, but there's uncertainty about those future states, and so there's a certain indeterminacy in the class structure. And that's real indeterminacy. You know, it's not just failure of imagination. It means that it's like a lottery. You know, if you're a worker and you know there's a 30% chance that you'll eventually be promoted into management, should you? What are your interests? Are your interests to side with workers in the struggle against management or not? If there's a 90% chance, 10% chance, all of these create uncertainties in the nature of one's relationship to the class structure. A third kind of complexity I already just briefly mentioned when I talked about an aspect of the skill issue, which has to do with capital ownership. In the abstract capital labor model, workers don't own the means of production, capitalists do. And workers sell their labor power to capitalists because they don't own the means of production. That's the standard way of describing this social relationship. But as a matter of fact, in developed capitalist societies, lots of workers, not just employees, but actual workers, do own some capital. Sometimes this takes the form of things like employee stock ownership programs in which they gain ownership of some stocks in their firms through retirement funds, through pension funds, workers do own a certain amount of stock, and owning a share in a corporation is owning a certain piece of capital. Now, one possibility is that this is so trivial and so marginal that it really doesn't have any strong bearing on the character of the class structure. It's just a little wrinkle. But it could reach the point which, for some segments of the working class, it becomes quite a significant part of their calculations and strategies. When they think about the long-term future, they're concerned about the returns on their investments, not just their ability to sell their labor power on the labor market. It might make workers have less clear-cut interest with respect to the movement of capital abroad, because on the one hand, it might make their own jobs more precarious. On the other hand, it might increase the stock value of their portfolio. Stock ownership in the United States has this peculiar character that it's both more diffuse than it used to be and more concentrated. Both things are true. That is, the richest 1% own a higher percentage of stocks, but a higher percentage of the population owns some stocks. Right? Both things are true. And this is just a new kind of complexity. I'm not arguing that it makes the system less, makes it more capitalist, that it means that workers are no longer workers. But to the extent that this becomes important, it's a new kind of, or additional kind of continuity of relocation.
Well, I was going to say that one way I think that some Marxists try to deal with this question is by arguing for like a life cycle, or one way in which they say the sort of motor production level on that is they argue for a life cycle understanding of worker savings. So workers might save and invest a good chunk or something at one point in their life, but they also might end up spending that all, say, on their children's education. And hence you can see it. So if you're looking, instead of at one worker at one specific time, if you're looking at workers across society, you can sort of see like a broad transfer. And hence you could maintain the argument that, or the abstraction that workers don't save.
Yeah, it might be, but I don't think it would be a good description of.
Well, I think it just depends on you would make that argument if you're trying to maintain a mode of production.
Right, but it would be, but still, empirically, I don't think it would be. I'm just saying empirically, it wouldn't be accurate. Mm-hmm. Some segments of the work, if by workers we mean people who sell their labor power full time on the labor market. Some segments of that category don't just save for part of their life and then liquidate it for the education of their children. They save throughout their whole life, and their children inherit small capital stocks. And that, I would argue, adds an additional form of complexity to class structures. Class structures are different when that's a characteristic feature than when it isn't. And I don't think it should be just wished away, you know, through some, but rather it should be understood and to see exactly how it works and whether the trends are towards a deepening of that kind of involvement of the working class in the stock market or a strengthening. How is it working? In some places, I know in Taiwan, for example, this is much broader than it is here. Stock ownership is much less concentrated and ownership is much more diffuse. The Minister of Education in Taiwan apparently had to pass a law that school teachers could not call their stockbrokers during school hours because they were spending too much time tracking the movement of their individual investments. You know, so they weren't just investing in mutual funds, they were investing in individual stocks. And it was a sufficient problem that a rule had to be passed that school teachers could not call their stockbrokers during the school day. Now, I mean, if that wasn't just an apocryphal story, it's a pretty interesting characterization of what I would call then a change in class structure. It's a distinctive kind of capital structure where you have to worry about a segment of the working class spending too much time calling their stockbrokers. Daniel.
This isn't necessarily totally on topic. How would you handle the idea of like a social deviance, like in a criminal way, like in the sense of like capital ownership and investment, things like that? What would you make of a worker embezzling money to the extent that it far outstrips whatever surplus labor there's being expropriated from them.
Well, let me answer it in two ways. One, about illegal activity more generally. From the point of view of class relations, illegal activity can be thought of in, I think, pretty much the same way as legal activity. You know, there are illegal enterprises with capital investment and employed workers who are exploited, and those are capitalist firms. The drug industry, you know, the illegal drug industry is essentially a form of capitalist enterprise, but in which the its relationship to the state is such that the actual organization and practices can be very different. So the fact that an activity is legal or illegal, I don't think bears directly on the question of what's the class good. Now, about somebody who embezzles from their employer, I don't know exactly how one would best treat it. I would say that a worker who manages to steal from the employer sufficient to wipe out the exploitation would be no longer, that particular worker would be no longer exploited. But I don't know if you'd want to say as a result of that that they've changed their class position, as opposed to they're an exploited worker who also is a self-employed petty criminal. You know, they have these two jobs. One is stealing from their employer and one is producing surplus for them. So it's a kind of peculiar contradictory location. They've got these two jobs.
Throw a monkey wrench at it.
Yeah.
I just want to know, is there empirical research on workers or professionals who have investment on stock markets? How many of them success?
Well, I don't know that research, but there is plenty of research on the investment behavior of different segments of the population. Until 2007, there was a lot of success. Of course, they invited a lot of these people.
Because nobody professional and many of the workers, they all can invest in stock market, but based on their professional knowledge, they can acquire different success or fail.
Mostly people invest in mutual funds, not individually invest in the stock market. That is, they don't attempt to acquire the kind of knowledge needed to pick particular stocks. Although, you know, this has changed quite dramatically with the internet, which has made it possible for people, you know, at night, at home, to do their own investments, do it on eBay. So more people do that. But I think the general pattern is, professors at the University of Wisconsin the university gives them a bunch of options for having payroll deductions that go into a mutual fund investment in which there are tax advantages to do so. You take pre-tax dollars and put them into a 401k type investment. Those are real investments. You can move them around from fund to fund. Some of those investments are high risk. You know, some are low risk, and some are socially screened, some are not. So there's all these different investment options. And most faculty at the University of Wisconsin take advantage of it. So that by the time they retire, you know, roughly, probably, I suppose, on average, a third of their retirement income comes from earnings from their portfolio, as opposed to either from the state pension or from Social Security. Something of that order of magnitude. And that's a real chunk of change. That's real money. That's not on the margins. Yeah.
I have a question about concept formation. If you can't find, or if one can't find, a concept that is both empirically valid and fits with a broader theoretical framework, that's the point at which you consider throwing out the broader theoretical framework. Is that right?
No, but that's the point at which you begin to worry about how to change the broader theoretical framework.
Reconstruct it before chucking it entirely.
Yeah, because I mean, you only chuck theories for better theories. You know, it'd be foolhardy to chuck a theory just because you're pissed off at it, because then you would never begin. Because any social science theory is going to be loaded with flaws, inconsistencies, gaps, ways in which the empirical work doesn't flow smoothly and comfortably, doesn't fit, concepts that are patchwork together. I mean, this is a chronic problem to anybody who takes these problems seriously. And it's really, you don't say, okay, I'm going to start from scratch. What does that even mean? You can't start from scratch. You might decide, what might easily happen is because you're less familiar with an alternative than with the theory and the framework you've been working with, and the grass is always greener on the other side, because you're less familiar with it, it might look better. So one, this is a little bit of a digression, but many people of my generation who began their work in a very self-consciously Marxian framework subsequently became Weberians. Right? They decided it wasn't worth the headaches of continuing to try to reconstruct Marxism and to make the concepts fit coherently and do the empirical work. But when you jump ship, so to speak, from the Marxist tradition to the Weberian tradition, you're jumping ship from a tradition that's attempting to build a coherent and systematic framework where the pieces fit together to one that doesn't care about that. In the Weberian tradition, is a rich and powerful set of ideas and concepts, but it isn't a theoretical framework in the same way that Marxism attempted to be. I've quipped that the advantage of Marxism is that you're capable of being surprised by the world. The advantage of Weberianism is that you're not capable of being surprised by the world. That whatever happens in the world, you can give a Weberian account of, because it doesn't make any, it doesn't create strong expectations. Marxism creates a very strong expectation that wherever you have sharp exploitation and a clean and polarized class structure, you're going to have class struggles. And if you didn't see any class struggles, you'd say, my God, there must be something really interesting going on here. Whereas Weberians don't have any expectations as to under what conditions you will or won't have class struggles of a particularly sharp character. And for any circumstance, they have a ready-made inventory of concepts that they can use to describe it. So, yes, that's a longer answer to the question than probably needed. But so, it's a very difficult, this issue of reconstructing theories, abandoning theories, at what point do you lose patience? I mean, in the context of social science, in which I really think that even Marxism is in a way not fully formed as a paradigm, in the way that Newtonian mechanics was, or evolutionary biology, are real paradigms. These are much more loosely coupled theoretical edifices with lots of sub-theories that are sound and interesting in their own right, and which have a certain affinity to the broader framework, but they're more modular than that, so that it isn't the case that running into difficulties there would really provide a definitive basis for saying, okay, it's time to chuck it all. Let me just mention briefly some remaining complexities. One has to do with unemployment and underemployment, or what might be more generally called dualism within labor markets. Philippe von Paris, he's Flemish, from Belgium. His last name, P-A-R-I-J-S, is pronounced Paris, not Paris, or, and it's the I-J is just a Flemish construction.
Paris.
Paris, yeah. Oh, it's true, we had a Dutch. Dutch and Flemish are basically the same thing, right?
Yeah, it's like a dialect.
Yeah.
It's
Paris. Philippe von Paris is an extraordinary Belgian philosopher, sociologist, one of my favorite intellectuals. He does fantastically interesting work. His current research, for those of you who might be interested, is on linguistic justice, on the problem of the dominance of English, the global dominance of English, and its implications for social justice. And he has this fantastic idea that all English speakers should be taxed to pay for English education around the world, because we are the beneficiary. English speakers have an unfair advantage in global settings by virtue of English being our native language. And the appropriate way of restoring linguistic justice is to have a global English tax to pay for English education in Turkey and...
Well, wait, what does that have to do with economics? Like, wouldn't it be more fair if we were taxed by way of forcing us to learn another language?
No, there's a huge...
I'm just saying, right? You know what I'm saying?
What he says is, look, we have the following are both true. There's a huge advantage to have a global lingua franca. That is, so that any two people in the world, educated people in the world, can meet and know that they share one language in common. That makes commerce, not just economic commerce, but just interactions, communications, tremendously easier than if everybody knows two languages, but there's no reason to expect that any one of the two languages will coincide. But it also gives English speakers an unfair advantage because it's their native language. And the question is there a way to get the advantage without the disadvantage? And the answer is to impose a disadvantage on English speakers, namely they have to pay this tax, to pay for the creation of a lingua franca. Anyway, this is just my way of saying what this guy who I admire greatly is currently working on. Now, he argues that in developed capitalist countries, this was more true in the late 80s and early 90s when he wrote this than it is today, but it's still true. There is a segment of the working class that really have something that are close to property rights in their jobs. That is, it's extremely hard for them to be fired. That's especially true for state workers in many parts of the world. It's true for tenured university professors. You know, you have to do really nefarious dereliction of duty to get fired. And even then, sometimes you don't get fired. So you basically have a quasi-property right. Now, it's not full property rights in your job because you can't sell it to somebody else. You can't give it away. But you have really strong rights to keep your job. And he argues that that's sufficiently strong and creates a sufficiently big divide in labor markets that it really has a class character to it. In Germany and France, there's been a series of institutional changes over the last 25 years or so, which has actually strengthened the rights of insiders to their jobs, making it harder to fire them, but reducing the size of people with such rights. So the unions and the political institutions have protected insider status against outsiders while reducing the proportion of the labor force covered by these insider rights. Well, von Paris argues that should really be thought of as a complexity class structure. We now have a working class that is separated from the means of production, but not separated from access to the means of production. That is, they don't own the means of production, but they have a guaranteed access to it in this quasi-property right of the job.
Could you add the quasi-inheritance mechanism in some countries to have a better sense of property? I mean, father... retires and the son comes in.
Right, so that if you actually can do that, it's an even stronger version.
Yeah. We can add this, but it doesn't make sense.
Right. That would be even one step further. Yeah.
That happens in many American factories currently. I mean, a similar structure is the temporary worker. A lot of factories have a set workforce, and when production goes up, they hire the temporary worker. When production goes back down, they can't help the temporary worker. It's very cyclical, especially for industries that exhibit production going up in a cyclical manner, like printing companies.
In Japan, that was the absolutely core of the Japanese economy. It's you know, more precarious now, but where people have lifetime contracts. So that was actually formalized as a lifetime contract, as is tenure at University of Wisconsin, when you get tenure at the university, it's a lifetime contract. The contract doesn't get renewed every year. It's a permanent contract. There's fine print that says if the university goes bankrupt, then they can cut tenured faculty, but it has to be a pretty extreme circumstance. So should that be considered a class division, as opposed to just a stratum? Are there these two kinds of workers, or is it really this is a class divide? And I think a case can be made that this is a class divide, that it creates the kinds of antagonisms of interest, which is characteristic of class. It has the character of oppression rather than exploitation in my language. That is, having those job rights is a form of exclusion, right? It's a way of opportunity hoarding, excluding others from access to a particular resource. And so insiders oppress outsiders. They don't necessarily exploit them at all. But still, it's a complexity that has to be considered.
How are they oppressing people?
What?
How are they oppressing people if they don't actively ensure that people can't get in those positions, but just actually hold those positions?
Well, but the rules that guarantee them lifetime employment harm outsiders.
So in order for them to not be oppressing, they would have to fight against those rules actively.
Right. And in fact, I mean, empirically what we observe in these situations, unions would have the option of fighting for the rights of the excluded, you know, to try to create protections for the excluded as well, but that's not what they do.
I'm just saying that, like, wouldn't it be the designers of the rules that were the oppressors and the people who were occupying those positions,
well,
not
the oppressors? Well, they're the beneficiaries of oppression, even if they're not themselves. You know, the white settlers who benefited from the kicking of Native Americans off the land, they're not themselves in terms of kicking, but they're the beneficiaries of it. So there is the case that their well-being depends upon the exclusion of others from access to those positions.
So we're all oppressors because we're beneficiaries of what people did in the past to the American Indian.
Yeah, I think that's, and that's why reparations is a reasonable claim. We are all, you know, a good argument can be made that all American citizens, by virtue of citizenship rules, which exclude labor from the rest of the world simply freely moving here, that's an act of oppression. We're protecting our access to a set of very valuable resources, living in a highly productive part of the planet with developed education and infrastructure and clean water. The forcible exclusion of migrant labor from access to this resource is something which we benefit from. If we had open borders, the average standard of living of indigenous U.S. citizens would almost inevitably go down if we had full open borders.
That's why it's not just purely maybe an oppression issue. It's also related indirectly to exploitation because it determines in some way the rate of exploitation.
Yeah.
It's in the same way that maybe an underclass or unemployed is not purely like categories, it also indirectly affects
them. Right, so there's those more complicated second order effects, sure. Very we're out of time. The last two complexities are whether there are global classes, whether the North is the global middle class, you know, so to speak, and the question of the state. Like many other topics this semester, we don't have time to go into everything. On Monday, the topic is the death of class debate, which is a topic for which I haven't yet prepared a lecture. I'm going to try to get it online by Friday. I'm going to be away for much of the weekend at a meeting in New York, so I'm going to try to get that online by Friday. I think Monday will also be an occasion for us to have a general discussion of this whole first part of the class structure discussion. See you all then. And Brittany, pass up your